to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 2nd of December, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, we're finally into the last month of the year. We've got Christmas coming up, and it's almost like Christmas has come early because I have my co-host here with me to start the week off, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello to you, sir. How are you doing? Are you having a good time? Have you had a good week off?
Yeah, I did have a really good week off, actually, yes. I did a bit of travelling. In fact, I was in London not so long back as well, which sort of ties in a little bit with one of the stories that we're going to be talking about here today. So when you go to London nowadays, you go to London with a certain amount of apprehension about, you know, what could actually happen. And it's just sad, really, that that is the case. But, I had a very enjoyable time there, and with no adverse events whatsoever.
Yeah, it's rather like going on safari, isn't it? You have to be a little bit adventurous going off to London now. You don't know, there might be an acid attack, there might be a stabbing, there might be a shooting, might be a terrorist attack, could be a suicide bombing, something like that. You just never know what's going to happen when you're in London now. It's such an exciting and vibrant place to be. It was particularly vibrant over the weekend. We had a vibrant ex-prisoner who enriched a social justice conference. In other words, we had another terrorist attack. Only the different thing about this terrorist attack was that they knew he was a terrorist. They'd actually locked him up for plotting to blow up the stock exchange, I think it was. And they let him off. They freed him, basically. But not to worry, we're all supposed to feel safe because he did have a tag around his ankle, which didn't prevent anything at all from happening. He suddenly just exploded into a fury, a stabbing frenzy at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon whilst at a social justice conference. I've got the details here. Two people were killed and up to 12 were injured after Osman Khan of indeterminate non-white ethnicity attacked innocent people on the north side of London Bridge just before 2 p.m. Video footage showed the attacker running across London Bridge wielding two large kitchen knives. Several white members of the public then chased Khan before tackling him and disarming him. One man used a fire extinguisher whilst another man ripped the tusk of a narwhal whale off a wall and jabbed it in the direction of the attacker. The terrorist was then bundled to the ground as other people waded in, while another man hurried away with his knife. The attacker was thought to have had one of the two knives strapped to his arm and had also been wearing a fake explosive device which was strapped around his waist. After the brave bystanders tackled the man to the ground, police intervened, pulling the heroes off the terrorist and getting them to safety. The officers were then seen lining up in close range of the man before he was shot to the chest. He was a convicted terrorist who had served time in prison and was wearing an electronic tag at the time of the attack. He was in London attending a Cambridge University conference on prisoner rehabilitation being held at Fishmongers Hall, and he had threatened to blow up the building. Learning Together is a group set up in 2014 by Cambridge University lecturers Ruth Armstrong and Amy Ludlow with the purpose of promoting social justice by bringing together people in criminal justice and higher education institutions. The killer is thought to have attended the morning session, taking part in various workshops in which he described his experiences as a prisoner, before launching his deadly attack without warning just before 2 p.m, stabbing fellow delegates with two large knives. This individual was known to authorities, having been convicted in 2012 for terrorism offences. Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu told reporters shortly after midnight on Saturday. I mean, you just could not make it up. This guy, they had him in prison, they let him out, and he was at a social justice conference, no doubt going to diversity lessons, I would have thought. But there are so many things to get into in this, but the one thing that really struck out to me was that the heroes of the day were white. It was four white men, and not just any four white men. Two of them, or maybe even three of them, were actually ex-prisoners, and they were the ex-prisoners that were at this conference, and they managed to take this guy down, even though, I mean, he had two huge knives, he had a bomb vest on him, and these brave white men took him down. They totally ignored all the advice, which is to run and hide. That's what we've been told. And Mayor Khan was actually on the television. He was saying, "Oh, I'm so proud of these citizens for apprehending him." And I thought, what have you got to be proud of? They're not your race. Your race was the one that was trying to do the killing. And these citizens actually totally ignored Mayor Khan's advice, which is to run and hide. You know, white people can be proud of the heroes, but I certainly don't think Mayor Khan can be. And that's the things that the first thing that really struck me about this was that it was white heroes, and they seemed to be playing that down at first and sort of saying diversity is a strength and we're all citizens together. And but, you know, we're not all citizens together. It's white people that just act in the instant like that in a courageous, heroic way, you know, putting their own lives on the line to rescue others. That's not something I think we would have seen from non-whites. What are your views on this, Max?
Well, I'd find it quite strange, first of all, that this chap actually attended the workshops in the morning and must have appeared to the other people as if he was a perfectly normal person. And then almost as if somebody had flicked a switch and he was some kind of automaton that suddenly went into sort of psychopath mode. He then produced these knives and started stabbing people. So it's quite strange, you know, that there would be that sudden transformation. You know, why would he attend in the morning and pretend to be interested and wanting to participate in the event, and then suddenly choose, you know, did something trigger him off, or I just wonder what his thinking was that made him attend in the morning and to appear to be perfectly normal and to offer his opinions with regard to various things and then to suddenly start killing, stabbing people with these knives. Yeah. So, and as you say, yes, the people that tackled him did defy the advice that was given to them, or that the police put out, that you should turn around and run. And I can recollect reading an article yesterday that was on the internet where the various people were giving their accounts of what had taken place, and I remember reading the account given by one person who was who said that as soon as this incident erupted, that everybody was running and he was running and his colleagues were running alongside him, and then just slightly ahead of him, an elderly woman tripped and fell. And he said, instead of anybody stopping to help her to her feet, they just ran over her because they were in such a panic. They just couldn't stop. And so presumably there's, you know, some little old lady somewhere who is probably in hospital today, having been trampled by the crowd of people running away. And I just think that it's a sad indictment, really, of our society that large numbers of people do just panic and run to such an extent that they would knock down and trample an old lady.
It's quick thinking to pull off one of these narwhal whale tusks. I mean, that was actually in this fish market building where they were having the diversity training. And I think it may have actually been the guy that was an ex-prisoner. He's actually an ex-prisoner for murder. I mean, quite a serious crime there. It's a horrible crime he was actually involved in. And I think he may have been the one that grabbed this narwhal tusk off the wall, because two of them came running out from this diversity training to take the guy down. Somebody else jumped out of a car, and I think there was an undercover transport policeman that was in the area as well, and he joined in. It was really quite shocking to see that this is just happening, you know, just on the streets of London. We hear of these stabbings every day, but this was a Muslim that they knew about. That's the thing that they knew about that carried this out. I mean, what was he doing free? Why did they think that just putting a tag around his ankle was gonna keep everybody safe? I mean, all that does is tell people where he is, and he wasn't from London. You know, his actual plan to blow up the stock exchange, his terrorism plan, that was all centered around London. But they let him go to this conference, and there's been some talk about did he have de-radicalization training, or was this conference a de-radicalization conference? Had he passed all of that? But the fact of the matter is, it wouldn't have mattered whether he passed that or not, because apparently the law is that these people, once they've done half their sentence, they have to be freed, regardless of the fact of whether they've been de-radicalized, whether they're still showing signs of being terrorists. And apparently that there's over 70 of these people that have been freed, just automatically freed to walk on our streets. People that have been charged with terrorism, plotting terrorism, that are now just walking about. They've said today that they're reviewing what they know about these people, but just the thought that they, you know, that there's over 70 of them just like that, that are walking about because of our ridiculous laws. And anybody with any common sense is looking at this and saying, why are these people here? This could not have happened if these people were not in our country. And if you know the bad eggs, you know the ones that are going to be likely to carry out terrorism, and you've already arrested them, you've already charged them, why weren't they sent back over to Pakistan or Kashmir or Afghanistan or wherever it is that they come from? Why was he turned loose upon our streets? Is it human rights law? You know, I mean, everybody with any common sense, that's what they're going to be saying to themselves. This easily could have been avoided. I don't know quite how it's going to affect the election. They both seem to be blaming each other. Boris Johnson is saying, well, it was the Labour Party that brought this law in, saying that automatic release after half a sentence, even for violent offenders. And the Labour Party are saying, yes, well, the Conservatives have been in power for the last 10 years and they didn't change that law. So they're both blaming each other. But the fact of the matter is, they're both guilty. You know, they both want more immigration. Neither of them are talking about deporting these criminals. And that's what needs to be done.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the original conviction of this chap, I think, was in 2012, where he was, well, I think it was before then, actually, but I think his sentence was revised in 2012, so that he only had to serve an 8 years of a 16-year sentence, and he was released at the end of the 8 years, but just released automatically without going through any kind of parole process to assess his suitability for release. He was just released automatically. But part of his, one of the conditions of his release was that he was banned from going to London. And interestingly, it was revealed in the news today that this ban on him going to London was lifted just for the one day so that he could attend this particular conference. So again, it's, you know, it's as if he put on a pretense that he was a rehabilitated person and wanted to be rehabilitated just for long enough so that he could have the opportunity to take advantage of one of these courses and get on the course, just so that he could go to London. Which was, you know, because London Bridge has been picked out before as a target area for this. I don't know what the fascination with bridges is, but a lot of these attacks seem to concentrate around bridges. And but it's, you know, he waited until he had the opportunity of committing this offence at London Bridge, and as I say, attended the workshop in the morning, and then with the flick of a switch, turned into, you know, homicidal murderer mode, and went on his rampage. And you would think that, as you said, that somebody having served the first sentence for a conspiracy to blow up the stock exchange, and I think that the group that he was with had identified a list of people that they wanted to kill and a list of places that they also wanted to blow up. So it was quite advanced in that respect. And I think that they had raised some money, that they were going to open a terrorist training camp in Kashmir on land that was owned by Usman Khan's family. And so this isn't somebody who was just very, very on the fringes of terrorism. This was somebody who was, you know, in the thick of it, really. And it's interesting that Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the attack subsequent to it taking place. And so therefore, there is evidently still some strong Al-Qaeda link to this chap. And why, when he was released, as you say, why wasn't he sent back to Kashmir where he came from, so that we as a nation would be free of any threat that he would subsequently pose? And I can remember going to a human resources lecture a conference it was rather, where a very experienced HR consultant was speaking and talking about the selection of people from a recruitment point of view. But what he was saying there is that very often people will recruit people that they think, oh, this person's got some talents, but there are some problem areas, but with the correct management, with the correct training, we can address these problem areas with this person's personality and make him better. And he said that that's completely the wrong approach. What he was saying effectively is that by the time somebody reaches their mid-20s, then their personality is fixed for life, and only some kind of extreme trauma will actually change their personality beyond that point. And so here we have Osman Khan, who is of an age where his personality, on the basis of what that HR consultant told me, would have been fixed. And as somebody who was a jihadi and an Islamic militant, then he's somebody that should have been regarded as never being safe to release into society again. And if he was going to be released into society, then he should have been released into a society that wouldn't tempt him to commit acts of terrorism. And if he'd been sent back to Kashmir, where the society in which he lived would have been, from an ethnic standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, and from a religious standpoint, in keeping with his own beliefs, then he would have no reason to commit any acts of terrorism. But releasing him back into British society, where the culture of our society and the prevailing religious beliefs, etc., are entirely different to those that he would have held, you know, that is effectively asking for trouble, isn't it? And it's quite true what somebody said over the weekend, that the government appear to be playing Russian roulette with the safety of the British people by just releasing people who are walking ticking time bombs, and who knows when something's going to flick the switch and turn them make them switch into homicidal maniac mode in the way that Osman Khan was, and so we're all at danger as a result of that.
You know, he was best buddies with Anjem Chowdhury, and it's interesting you bring up the fact that he was Al-Qaeda have claimed responsibility for this. I mean, they'll look around, see if there's connections with Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, but it's just extremist Muslims. They don't need to have any contact with Al-Qaeda or Islamic State. All they have to do is read the Quran and read the Hadiths and look for the preachers online or whatever it is, and that's the understanding that they've got. And how are they going to see whether he's been de-radicalized or not when you've got judges telling these jihadis, when they've got them in the courtroom, that what they need to do when they go to prison is study the Quran? I couldn't believe that when I heard that a few months back. There was one of these jihadis who was being sent to prison, and the judge said, you'll have plenty of time when you're in there to study the Quran and realize that Islam is a religion of peace. So how are you going to tell whether these guys have been de-radicalized or not when they're still reading the same book? Yeah, you know, it's just the mind boggles what goes through the minds of these judges when they say ridiculous things like this. You mentioned there, Max, about the fact that he was sort of conning them that he had been rehabilitated. The actual guy that was murdered, his dad's been on the television and he's been saying, oh, he would have hated to have seen this politicized. He always took the side of the underdog. He always took the side of the prisoner, basically. And so his father still hasn't learned You know, this guy was taking the side of the prisoner, and what did this ex-prisoner do? Well, he stabbed him to death. And instead of realizing that his son's good nature was taken advantage of like that, the father is saying, oh, he would have hated to see this politicized and to affect these prisoners that want to be let out early. I mean, it's absolute madness. One thing that does concern me a bit about this, if they're going to do this right, we're going to crack down on the terrorists. We're not going to let them out after halfway through or whatever. There's a problem with that, because they will apply that to some of the white lads that have been charged under terrorist legislation for things like putting stickers up. And I worry that they might get caught up in the fallout from it, and they might not be allowed to be released halfway through. We know that already they've had limits put on who they can actually contact with on the outside, and they are treated exactly the same as if they are, you know, as if they're just as dangerous as these Islamic terrorists that, you know, that blow themselves up and stab people. And there's just no equivalent there with things like putting stickers up. So that does concern me, where this is going to go, about the politics of it all, and when the next one is going to be. I mean, they do seem to like doing these things around about Christmas time, and they do seem to like doing these things around about the time when we have an election. I mean, also, over in The Hague, there was a shopping centre there, and everybody was out doing their Christmas shopping, and there were three youngsters that were stabbed. I think they were all under the age of 15. So like 13, 14, 15, and they haven't caught the attacker, and there's been no description given of the attacker. I wonder why there was no description given of him. And even with this, you had the Neil Basu, the head of anti-terrorism, saying we are investigating this as a terrorist incident on the one hand, and then you had the BBC reporters straight after Neil Basu saying this, saying, well, there's nothing to confirm that this is actually terrorism yet. We don't know this is terrorism. And you can see in the pictures that it's a guy with a big beard. I mean, why else would somebody start trying to stab people if not for Islamic terrorism? There's nobody else that talks about stabbing random innocent people, and that's the way to wage jihad. You know, you don't get white people doing that. No, nobody does that apart from these Islamic terrorists. And the final thing really that struck me about this as well was actually watching the police officer when he shot him. He really didn't seem that well trained with the gun to me. He seemed nervous. You know, his hands weren't sort of held very still. And it really didn't give me that much confidence in our armed police. I mean, maybe I'm used to seeing too many movies where they shoot, where guns go off. But this police officer really didn't seem that confident of what he was doing. It didn't inspire me with confidence anyway.
Yeah, well, I think there, though, what you've got to bear in mind is that as with our armed police and similarly with our troops, when our troops are deployed anywhere in the world, if they're called upon to shoot somebody, what will be going through the back of their mind is that, you know, is the time going to come in perhaps two or three decades' time, when they reach retirement age, that they will be dragged up before a court for committing murder on the basis that somebody subsequently turns around and says, oh, well, they shot and they really shouldn't. They didn't have to shoot. They could have done something else. They could have tased at the man. And so I can imagine that police officers that are armed response officers that turn up at these kind of things will always have that thought at the back of their mind. But also, it's another thing is that, you know, a lot of these police officers have been trained, they've been given a gun, and they will have shot at targets, but they will never have actually shot somebody in real life, and they probably would never have shot somebody at close range. As anybody that's ever seen live action in any kind of warfare situation will tell you, you know, when you shoot your first person, it is a fairly sort of emotional thing, because, you know, it's something that's a very significant event for anybody, and one which is, you know, where there will be all sorts of emotions that will be sort of spinning through the person's head. So I can sympathise to a certain extent with the police officers involved, and you know, sympathise Secondly, as I said, first of all, that they probably will have at the back of their mind the question of whether or not they will at some future date be prosecuted for shooting the person unnecessarily.
Oh, they were saying that.
Somebody to come forward. It just requires somebody to come forward from a crowd that's been carrying a camera that from a particular angle it looks as if they perhaps didn't have to shoot, and in which case they're then dragged up and their careers are wrecked and they'll find themselves prosecuted and sent to prison.
There was people saying that on Twitter. There was, I saw there was a tweet that was being retweeted that was saying, you know, they didn't have to shoot him. The guy was down. He was restrained, but he had what appeared to be a suicide vest on. It was a fake one, but that's what it appeared to be. That's what they need to do. They need to shoot someone like that who is trying to stab people. And it was obviously premeditated. I mean, maybe he. When they had the lunch break, maybe he had his knives in a bag or something and then taped them to his arms. But, normally when you go into a court or any of these places, they normally, they have a metal detector there and they search you on the way in. So how did he manage to get these knives in there and this vest? They said that one of them he had taped to his arm and they had to get that off him. But, that's a pretty big kitchen knife. You can see it in the shots that were taken, in the video that was taken. It is predictable. We are expecting this sort of thing. And also there's egg on the face of whoever it is that does the terrorism threat thing, because they just marked it down. It was substantial, and they just marked it down to, not quite as dangerous as it was before. And straight away, we've got another of these attacks. The only place these attacks don't happen are places that don't have Muslims. It's that simple. They don't have them in Japan. They don't have them in China, where they don't have these Uyghur Muslims. They don't have them. It's an Islamic thing.
Just picking up on those two points that you just made there, the decision to lower the rating for the terrorist. What's the word I'm thinking of here?
Threat level.
The threat level. That's right. Yes, the decision to do that was probably motivated by virtue of the fact that we're coming up to a general election, and they wanted everybody to feel relaxed and think, oh, the threat levels are going down. The situation in the country is better than it has been in the past, etc., and to make people feel good about the election and presumably vote for the government, And really what they should have been thinking was, Christmas is coming and these kind of attacks tend to have a habit of occurring around about Christmas time, because they're motivated by kind of anti-Christian thoughts on the part of the people that are carrying out the attacks. So that's really what they should have thought about there. But with regard to the dummy suicide vest that the chap was wearing, was it a dummy vest? Because the point is, while some people have described it as being a dummy vest, other people have said that that there was an initial flurry of shots fired by the police, four shots, and then there was a kind of a banging sound, which sounded like it could have been an explosion. Some eyewitnesses said that they did see a small explosion. So it may be that he was wearing a vest that may not have contained quite as much explosive as he originally thought, and which perhaps just made a bit of a bang. Yes, as far as the police officers are concerned, the ones that attended there and decided to shoot him, the fact that he was wearing a vest was their justification, because had he actually been wearing a vest that was fully loaded with explosives, it could have caused a lot of damage and could have caused a lot of deaths. So yeah, their decision was correct.
These things, they happen at Christmas time, and they also happen at Eid as well, around the Muslim festival of Eid. But again, it's entirely predictable. It could quite easily have been prevented. Just if they deported the terrorists that they know are terrorists, and the ones that they know are Islamic radicals, if they just deported them, it would substantially reduce the terrorism risk. And if they were to deport all the non-whites, or even just the ones that had criminal records, you would reduce the crime rate in Britain massively, absolutely massively. you know, the ratio of crimes committed by non-whites compared to crimes committed by whites is huge. It's a huge ratio. I mean, it's up to 10 times as many young black men involved in extreme violence than whites are. It's a simple solution to the problem, and nobody is speaking about it. The only people that are speaking about it are the nationalists. Well, we've got another of our greatest Britons to talk about now. I know people have been looking forward to this because people have said as much to me. And interestingly enough, he was dealing with an invasion of his country as well back then in the 9th century, Alfred the Great. And funnily enough, he didn't outlaw criticism of the invaders. He didn't start locking people up for pointing out that a lot of rape and pillaging was going on, and it was these Danish Vikings that were carrying it out. Instead, he fought against them and eventually segregated them and put them in a separate area, amongst lots of other wonderful things. And I mean, he's a real hero of mine, Alfred the Great is. When I first got into nationalism, I bought myself the book, The Life of Alfred the Great, and I was amazed at just what a great man he was and how well he deserved the title of Alfred the Great. And we'll hear all these amazing things that he did as we go along. Before I get into that, I'll just ask you on your opinion of Alfred the Great, Max. Have you come across him before? Well, I suggested we discuss him.
Yeah, Alfred the Great is well known. I suppose I would have first come across him at school when I would have been taught about him in history. I don't know that children are taught about people like Alfred the Great in history any longer, but he was a king who reigned during the period that the Vikings were raiding and invading the British Isles, and he fought to establish England, really, to create England, because prior to this period, England had been divided into the four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, which were Mercia, Wessex, East Anglia, and Northumbria, from what I can recollect. And so those four smaller kingdoms hadn't at that point been united, and it was Alfred's dream to unite those kingdoms and create England. And so for anybody who is an enthusiast for British nationalism, that would be he is obviously a key person in history.
Yeah, that's a good place to start, is with King Alfred. He was the King of Wessex from 871 to 886, and he was the King of the Anglo-Saxons from 886 to 899, as you say, because he managed to unite these kingdoms. And he was actually on very good terms with the Welsh as well, and the Irish. In actual fact, by the end of his reign, he had quite a lot of foreign diplomacy was going on, and the Welsh had actually gone to him and said, well, the South Welsh had gone to him and said, can we join up with you? Which they actually did. His early life, he was the youngest son of King Ethelwulf of Wessex, who died when he was young, and three of Alfred's older brothers, Ethelbald, Ethelbert, and Ethelred, all reigned in turn before him. And he wasn't really expecting to be king because he had these three older brothers, but they all eventually ended up being killed by the Danes, and he was made king by default. But before that, he was supposedly taken to Rome while he was very, very young, where Pope Leo IV blessed and anointed him as the future King of England. And it's probably more likely that he was just christened by the Pope or some Christian ceremony that actually went on, because it was his three older brothers that would have been the kings of England. But we are also told that as a child, Alfred won a book of Saxon poems offered as a prize by his mother to the first of her children able to memorize it. And legend has it that the young Alfred spent time in Ireland seeking healing as well. He was troubled by health problems throughout his life, which we are told he prayed for to distract his mind from licentious thoughts, which we'll get into a bit later. He was healed of his piles before his wedding night, but later in life had much worse health problems, and it is thought today that he may have suffered from Crohn's disease. He actually prayed to be given piles because he didn't want licentious carnal thoughts, and he wanted some kind of a disease that wasn't outwardly visible to distract his mind from thinking about women, basically. And miraculously, the piles appeared, and he was distracted from thinking about women, and they miraculously disappeared before his wedding night. But then he was afflicted with this this other disease that they think is Crohn's disease. And one thing that when I first read about this with the Saxon poems, I was thinking, well, he didn't learn to read until he was much older. So how did he memorize this book? But it must have been that one of his teachers read the book out to him, and he remembered it, which is telling us that he had a very good memory when he was a young child, and he was given this book of poems by his mother. Do you want to comment on any of that there, Max, his early life?
I think to agree with you that the fact that he was able to memorize this book was a significant thing, which obviously then showed that he had a good mind, and I think that then played out in his later life. I don't think he was renowned as being a particularly skillful warrior or anything of that sort. I think he was an adequate warrior, but I don't think he was shown to be a particularly skillful warrior. But what he did do was he exercised a great amount of skill in terms of forging alliances with people and in terms of motivating people and inspiring people to action, basically. And so having a good mind, being a persuasive person and a good speaker, I put him in good stead for that.
He was a good strategist, I think, with these battles and later on some of the military improvements that he made and with the navy. But after acceding to the throne, Alfred spent several years fighting a losing battle against the great heathen army who had arrived in 866. The Vikings would regularly break their oaths, which was not something the Christian Saxons were used to. They would swear upon Thor and accept hostages, but they would then just slaughter the hostages and do what they had promised they wouldn't do. And it was through tricks like this that Alfred was eventually forced into hiding in Athelney, with Wessex being the only kingdom left that had not actually fallen to the Vikings. So he was in a really bad way. The people thought that the king has gone missing. We don't know where he is. And it was during this time that he supposedly burned the cakes whilst deep in thought about his predicament whilst in hiding. And that's the story that all the school children know about. Alfred, he's the guy that burnt the cakes and got a scolding from the farmer's wife who was in this house that he was staying in. Apparently that legend comes from the life of Saint Neot, who some people have also said that Saint Neot was actually a brother of Alfred, but that hasn't actually been confirmed. And the legend about the cakes is not in the, it's not actually in the life of Alfred the Great. But these Vikings, I mean, they were really fierce. They had a thing called the Blood Eagle, where they would tear your back open, pull your insides out, and put salt on them. And this Blood Eagle is actually mentioned in the life of Alfred the Great. But he was in a real predicament. But it shows that there was a good system that he had in place once he did actually show himself. I don't know if you want to comment on that at all, Max, burning the cakes and the heathen army.
Yes, I don't know whether the burning of the cakes actually did happen. It possibly could have done. I think it was, if it did happen, it would have been in a situation where he perhaps had been left in charge of some cakes, but because he had more important things to think about, he didn't really bother about them and just let them burn, basically. As far as the heathen army is concerned, yes, I mean that the Vikings were expanding at that time. They had landed in the east of England and were spreading westwards, and which is when they came into contact with Mercia and Wessex. And yes, Alfred and his one of his older brothers, I think it was the second. oldest one to him, who I think was just something like 18 at the time, but who was king. He fought very bravely in a whole succession of battles, some of which the outcomes were fairly sort of indeterminate. There was a battle in 1871, the Battle of Ashdown, that the Saxons clearly won. They won a decisive victory on that particular occasion, and Alfred was credited with leading the Saxons to victory on that particular occasion. But then there were other occasions subsequently to that where the Saxons were defeated, and that's when the this slightly older brother died shortly after that. I think it was in 1871, and then there were other, pardon?
871.
Sorry, 871. So, and then there were a number of battles that the Danes, that the Saxons had with the Danes. And part of the problem was that the Vikings tended to fight a kind of almost like a guerrilla war, where they would raid somewhere, and then when the Saxons mounted a counterattack, they would effectively escape and not face the counterattack, and they would go on somewhere else and then raid somewhere else. And so it was a very difficult situation in those days for anybody who was trying to establish peace and a peaceful kingdom. The fact that the raiding Vikings were very highly mobile and were able to travel even on foot and on horseback, were able to travel, you know, very quickly. And had a number of ships that were very fleet and had a low draft, so that they could travel a long way up rivers and provide a means of escape for the Vikings, so that they could escape ahead on confrontation with the Saxon forces. And I think there were two sort of distinct styles of warfare there. One on the part of the Anglo-Saxons, where the technique that they adopted was to form a shield wall and then to advance as a wall of men into an enemy and do battle that way, whereas the Vikings preferred not to have these pitched battles in that respect, and, as I say, would strike, burn, rape and pillage, and then escape as quickly as they could before any sizable Saxon force could arrive. And so one of the things that Alfred had to do in his later life was to devise a means by which the Saxons could counter that mobility of the Vikings and eventually rid themselves of the threat that the Vikings posed.
Yeah, this was a problem. They weren't settlers. They would rape and pillage and they would burn, they'd destroy, monasteries and lots of scripts and loads of books were lost at the time. The standard of education, just, nobody could even write at the time this was going on, because everything had just been destroyed by them. And then they would just move on to somewhere else. You know, if they were agriculturalists, if they were trying to settle, you couldn't get away with doing that, because the Saxons would know where you were, and they would be able to, extract vengeance upon you. But what these Vikings would do is just take whatever they could, and then they'd be off, and they'd go and do the same to somewhere else. And, his brother there that you mentioned, Max, he was a particularly pious man as well. There was one battle, and they're all lined up ready for the battle, and it came to, they would either have to admit defeat or they would have to charge. And his brother was still in his tent saying mass, and his brother refused to come out of the tent until he had actually finished saying mass with his priest. So Alfred had to start anyway, and he did actually win that battle. But that's a particularly famous one. They did take their Christian faith extremely seriously, and this wasn't the Christian faith that came from Augustine. This was the Christian faith that came from the Britons. It was the Celtic Church. This is why Alfred went to the Celtic Church to get Bishop Asser to come and write the life of King Alfred. later on. So he was having all these battles. He was losing a lot of these battles. They lost the Three Kingdoms. Alfred is in hiding, basically. His people thought he was lost to them, but he regained his courage and appeared to them, rallying the inhabitants of Somerset, Wiltshire, and Hampshire. And this was around a famous stone, Egbert's Stone, and he appeared to them there, and they all rallied to his call. And this is, you know, this is actually a testament to the loyalty that the Saxons actually had to their king, because he'd been missing for quite some time, and he appeared. And instead of saying, "Well, we haven't been paid for a long time," or "Well, we don't like this system of the caste system where you've got thanes and lords and serfs," they actually kept to that system. And when the king appeared, they still rallied to him. And then they went and surprised the Vikings with a decisive victory at Edington in 878, where they pursued the heathen army to their stronghold, and then they basically starved them into submission, because they had actually got a base this time, and the Saxons were just around the outside of it, and you know, they were starving, these Vikings were. And one of the terms of surrender was to accept baptism, and this had always gone badly before, because they broke their oaths. But this time, they actually took it seriously, and Alfred adopted Guthrum, who was the leader of the Vikings, as his spiritual son in the baptism ceremony, which was an Orthodox ceremony. When you read the life of Alfred the Great, it makes mention of a chrism, and that's used by the Orthodox. It's not something that's found in the Catholic Church, which shows you that Britain at that time was Anglo-Orthodox. Even though the church didn't split until 1060, and then you've got Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox, the Orthodox Church revere Alfred the Great as a saint. He's Saint Alfred the Great to them. And this ceremony actually took quite a few days, and they exchanged gifts. And Guthrum actually became a very, very loyal associate of Alfred's, and it was this that actually led to the creation of the Danelaw in the north, and the unification of the Angles and the Saxons under Alfred in the south. And then you finally had this peace between the two peoples, and the Vikings took it seriously that they were going to be Christian. And I think the very fact that there was then segregation, you had the Danelaw in the north and you had the Saxons in the south, I think that, you know, that led to the peace, really, because the Vikings were then putting down roots, and they were settling and planting crops and all the rest of it. And I think they exchanged women, and they came to an agreement with the laws that they had, which we'll get into a little bit later. But this was the point. Alfred managed to rally his troops together, and the tide suddenly turned, and he was winning, and he managed to negotiate this peace and also Christianize the Vikings at the same time. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Yeah, just the fact that the as you say, the Vikings had retreated to Chippenham, where they were then besieged and starved into submission, Guthrum converted to Christianity and was baptized. I think he was given the name Æthelstan after that. That was his baptismal name. But this is part of what I was referring to earlier on, which is the skill that Alfred had in terms of persuading people using reason to follow his leadership. And it was, I think, the treaty between him and Guthrum became known as the Treaty of Wedmore, and this was basically between Alfred in Wessex, Guthrum, or Æthelstan as he became known then, in East Anglia, and they then agreed to divide Mercia between the two of them. So there was a line drawn following various natural features which split Mercia into two, and Alfred took the western part of Mercia, and Guthrum took the eastern part. And then that was when the area under Guthrum, which consisted of part of East Anglia and Mercia, became known as Danelaw. And Alfred was then king of the Anglo-Saxons, and but it wasn't very long after that treaty was created that that Guthrum actually died, and then that left the Vikings in East Anglia in a much more weakened situation. And in fact, a lot of them, after Guthrum had made the pact with Alfred, had left the UK altogether and had gone to Ghent, I believe it was. So they'd gone on over to the continent and then continued their sort of pillaging and whatever over there. And so that it then introduced a period of relative tranquility and peace that then prevailed over England, which was good. And it wasn't until some years later that the Viking army returned. And this time when the Viking army returned, it returned together with all of its all of the wives and the children of the Viking warriors, and they invaded the they invaded Kent. And the fact they brought their women and children with them indicated that they were intending to colonize part of a part of England, and that then created again another period of fighting, and there was then like a whole succession of battles where Alfred was continually with his army chasing these Vikings, and each time they would raid and then they would move on and raid and move on, and continually using these lighter, more nimble ships that they had in order to evade a direct confrontation, in order to evade capture. And so it was that really that then caused Alfred to focus his mind on creating a system that would be able to react quickly the moment any Vikings landed. I don't know whether that's something that we're going to get into that next.
I just want to add something about the Wergild. When they made that treaty up, they also, a large part of that treaty was the value of the Vikings and the value of the Saxons, and the equivalent between the classes of the Vikings and the classes of the Saxons. And if a Viking was to be injured, the Saxons were to pay them a certain amount of Wergild, and if a Saxon was to be injured, the Vikings were to pay the Saxons a certain amount of Wergild. And that formed a large part of the treaty, was that this Wergild system, which I think was the, you know, it was the first time that they'd actually brought in these financial payments, compensations for committing a crime, basically, and for harming somebody, which is which, you know, we kept to for quite some time after that. We will get into what Alfred did to protect the country in the next bit, Max, but did you want to talk some more about that? I mean, did those Vikings, when they invaded later on, did they make their way back up to the Danelaw? I mean, were they seeking to recolonize that bit, or were they, you know, just seeking to make more raids?
Well, from what I can see, that they were raiding predominantly along the south coast of England, but also some of them did go inland, and there was that there were some battles in Wiltshire, I believe. But it seemed that although they had landed in Kent and had brought their women and children with them, that they were still able, despite that, to move very quickly and to outrun Alfred, who was then sort of having to chase after them all the time, and they were able to evade him and then reappear somewhere else. And so that then created the problem that then caused Alfred to devise his
Burr system. Yeah. It's also
Burr
called
system. Burrs. There's no G in it. That's right. Yeah. So the Burr system, which was then used to finally rid England of the Viking threat. But it was during the 880s and the 890s that Alfred then developed the legal system, and this probably would have been the first written legal system anywhere in the UK. But he collected together parchments, because what had happened during the period of all the Viking raids, which, you know, lasted for some considerable time, because The monasteries had been raided and ransacked and burnt and robbed. And the manuscripts that had been kept within the monasteries very often had been burned. So the educational system in the UK had broken down, because it was the monasteries and the monks that were the main providers of education for people in those days. And so in order for, first of all, for ancient manuscripts to be preserved and so that a uniform legal system could be imposed across England or the area that Alfred reigned over, he gathered together all of these manuscripts and then created a legal code combining, I think, traditional customs and traditional principles and mores with those that he'd taken from the Bible. And I believe that he based a lot of his legal code on the Ten Commandments from the Bible, but created this legal code, which was composed of 120 chapters. And that again was something which contributed greatly to the peace that eventually prevailed over the country.
Yeah, we'll get into that next week, and the Molmutine laws that it was based upon, because we had this King Molmutius around about 400 BC, and he was the first one to create a law code. But at the time that he made this treaty with Guthrum, they didn't really have any of that. It's quite a basic stripped down treaty, and it's just we'll pay you this much for harm that's done to your men, and you pay us this much for harm that's done to our men. And that sort of did for the time. And Guthrum and his men, they finally started settling the land up there in the north and working an agricultural life instead of piracy. But Alfred still had to contend with other attempts made at sea by the Vikings not aligned with Guthrum. And that could be the ones that you were mentioning, Max, that came in at Kent. But now that he did have some semblance of peace, he set to work repairing London, because that had been utterly destroyed, and inviting scholars from Europe to help educate himself and his people. There's a report, which I'll probably quote next week, which shows you that they couldn't even write Latin. There was nobody left in the land that could even write Latin anymore. This is one of the reasons why he had to go to Wales and get the people from the church over there to help. But he also brought people in from France, from Charles the Bald, he was quite friendly with. He had actually gone to visit him at some point. But he then started reinforcing the defences. And the next time the Vikings came, they found a standing mobile field army that was ready to chase after them, a network of garrisons and a small fleet of ships that were navigating the rivers and estuaries. We'll get into the ships probably next week as well. But the main thing that he did was he started building these boroughs by repairing the defences around the outside, digging ditches, and then connecting them all together by roads. And then they could survive within this burgh if they were under siege, and reinforcements could travel by road to the rescue of the people that were inside this burgh. So if the Vikings came, they would all run up inside the village that was all protected on the outside, and they had enough food in there. And of course, in order to do this, he had to raise taxes, and there were people that said, well, you know, we don't want to be paying out this money for this. And he was like, okay, fine, don't pay the money for it, don't build yourself a burgh. And they would then get attacked by the Vikings, and they would realize the error of their words. So and then they were quite happy to, the rest of them were quite happy to pay their taxes, and he built all these boroughs up. And as I say, with these roads together, I mean, it's a very, very clever idea. That's where we get the term borough from. You get the different boroughs in London, and you get often like Middlesbrough. It's found as the second part of the name of lots of places around the country. And that goes back to Alfred the Great building up these boroughs and repairing the defences, which helped him to protect his people from these raids from the Vikings. Do you want to talk a bit more about these boroughs, Max? Do you know much about the architecture involved, the work involved?
No, I'm not particularly versed in that, except I agree with what you've just been saying, that my understanding is that that's exactly what he did, so that by having these roads connecting the boroughs and by building them, he created, first of all, defences, but also a way in which the Anglo-Saxons could react quickly if there was an invasion by the Vikings, and it created a system that would contain the Vikings far more easily than existed beforehand. And this was probably the biggest factor in limiting the mobility of the Vikings, so that the threat from them could eventually be overcome.
Yeah, the road bit, I think, is an important bit that sometimes gets left out. I mean, they talk about these boroughs and you think, well, they've got these defensive places, but he also built roads in between them. So if the Vikings appeared and one load of villagers had to run inside their burgh, then they could, you know, light a fire or get some smoke going or start ringing bells or whatever. And the people from around would then be able, from the nearby boroughs, would then be able to send out this mobile army, because he also had an army by that point. He was paying people to be his army at all times. He actually had them in three different groups. So you had one group that was the standing army for 1 month, and then they would have 2 months off. So at all times, there was a standing army ready to react if the Vikings were there. And he didn't have that before. It was just, everybody, when it happens, they've got to, you know, get ready to fight. Whereas when he had the standing army there ready, they were all ready to fight. They were just waiting to be told the Vikings are here. You know, they're all ready. They've got their armor. They've got their weapons. They've got their ammunition. They've got the horses, got everything that they need. And they're just waiting for that signal. And it wasn't like that before. So that was a large part of this as well. So when the Vikings arrived, they weren't expecting that. So he was able to, again, he was able to defeat them. And because he put a stop to this pillaging and this raping and this burning of everything, he was able to start implementing these policies of improving the life of his people, because that was Alfred's drive, was his people, the Anglo-Saxons. And outside of that as well, you know, he wasn't a bad king. He helped out the Danes, he helped out the Welsh, all these different tribes that were living on the island of Great Britain at the time. He was trying to get on well with them by the end of his reign. Anyway, we're going to get into that next week, I think, Max. We've gone a little bit over here now. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.